We're talking about how to stop the surge in drug overdose deaths here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, glad you could be here. A new report out from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it estimates more than 93,000 people died from drug overdose deaths last year, rising sharply during the first year of the pandemic. President Biden at a CNN town hall in Cincinnati last month said there aren't nearly enough people involved in mental health and drug addiction services.
We shouldn't be sending people to jail for use. We should be sending them mandatory rehabilitation. Mandatory rehabilitation.
Have you lost someone to an opioid overdose? How has it affected you and your family? Could you access addiction treatment services in your community? 800-642-1234. Dr. Nora Volkoff is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Volkoff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. You know, health experts, they pretty uniformly have told us that overdose deaths would be up last year. But did you expect such a sharp rise year over year from non-pandemic times?
No, we expected that there could be a rise because of the difficulties for patients to access treatment and also because of the stress and isolation. But we didn't expect that it would go to 30%, that 31% almost for the latest numbers from CDC. So it's the largest rise we've ever seen from one year to the other in increases in overdose deaths. So it was larger than we had expected.
Larger than you had expected. And you really point to the stress, the isolation as significant barriers. What about the treatment barriers?
Treatment became harder because many of the community services that were available for patients to access treatment or support were closed in 2020. And the healthcare system that helped to provide, for example, through the emergency department, screening and treatment of individuals could no longer do it. So there was a decrease in the availability of places where patients could get treatment, as well as in support systems that are so relevant for people to be able to sustain recovery. So all of those were impediments.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Carry on.
There was a very good move to actually try to facilitate access to medications by making it easier to prescribe buprenorphine, which is one of the medications that we use to treat opioid use disorders. So in the past, you needed to physically see a doctor that was waived in order to give it to you. And in March, there were changes made so that you could be prescribed buprenorphine through telehealth or a call. And that facilitated and expanded the number of patients that could get access to treatment. And also, they made changes so that the methadone clinics were able to send patients with take out methadone for up to 4 weeks. As opposed to requiring them to go on a daily basis to a methadone clinic, which is quite difficult to actually sustain. And under the conditions of the COVID, it made it even much worse. So those two changes actually helped buffer what otherwise would have been an even worse situation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Nora Volkoff, who is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the NIH. And we're looking at this sharp rise in overdose deaths in the pandemic and where to go from here. With your insights and experiences, have you or a loved one struggled with drug addiction? How have you managed through the pandemic? Have you lost someone to an overdose? How has that affected your family? 800-642-1234. Dr. Volkoff, going back to these support systems, Wisconsin's health department announced earlier this month that our state will get nearly $50 million in additional funding from the federal government for prevention and treatment services. That's money from ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act that Congress approved. Is this type of money enough to boost mental health services to a level that you think will meet the need that you see in communities of all sizes?
I would say it's a first good start, but we do recognize that ultimately the magnitude of the problem and the need to actually, on the one hand, provide treatment and support for recovery, and on the other, to actually expand our prevention interventions so that we don't keep actually trying to control a growing epidemic of drug use and addiction in our country, we are going to require more resources. And but it is good that there is attention and recognition that we need to put resources in order to provide with treatment. And also, I think another aspect about it in terms of not just resources, I think that there has to be a commitment to ensure that those resources are used properly and that they are used for evidence-based and high-quality treatments.
Dr. Volkoff, we heard from Suzanne in Milwaukee, called in and couldn't stay with us. Suzanne said they had a family member die from opioids in 2019, and the family member was willing to get treatment, but there was no affordable treatment that was available to them. What about the barriers to affordability?
Yeah, no, and I'm very sorry and for the loss of your family member. And it's not the first time I've heard it. I've heard it many times. And it's heartbreaking to hear that someone that wanted to go to treatment could not access it because of they couldn't afford it. And that should not be. A treatment should be affordable for everyone that needs it. And so one of the main strategies for addressing the current crisis that we're living in our country is to provide for treatment. This will require that the treatment is accessible. And it's, as I mentioned before, is quality, high quality and evidence-based, but also accessible and should be covered by insurance, or whether it's private, Medicaid, Medicare. And that has always been an issue, even though it is right now unlawful not to provide for treatment of substance use disorder. If someone, just like it is unlawful not to provide for treatment for a medical condition. So, but it's not always implemented. Unfortunately, these laws are not implemented. And many patients that could have, whose life could have been saved had they received treatment, did not access it.
Yeah, it's not getting sometimes at the local level. You know, I want to turn to naloxone. There is a national shortage of the opioid overdose reversal drug, and we also hear it's call it by the brand name Narcan. Pfizer's website labels its availability as depleted. I just checked this morning. What is the status of this shortage? What can you tell us?
Yeah, no, we have been hearing from harm reduction groups that they have had difficulty accessing the low-cost naloxone for injection. And to, first of all, for those that may not be knowledgeable, naloxone is a medication that is actually what we call an antagonist. It binds to the same receptor than heroin or fentanyl, and it blocks it. And so if you give it to someone that has overdosed, the drug immediately pushes the fentanyl or the heroin out of the receptor, and it saves the life. It's almost like a miraculous drug. Mm-hmm. And it has actually, so the challenges are you have to administer it rapidly and at the correct dose, and you save a life. But if the medication is not available, then of course you cannot save the person's life. And what we're hearing is effectively by the harm reduction communities that they are having difficulty accessing the low-cost naloxone. So because Pfizer, I mean, you have a generic naloxone and a brand naloxone that is more expensive. And in order to provide all of the doses that are necessary to save lives, you actually, the organizations rely on the low-cost naloxone, which is the same drug, it's just that it's set up as a generic. The harm reduction organizations are responsible for having, my understanding is, given in 2020 more than 1.2 or 1.3 million doses of naloxone. And again, I reiterate, administering naloxone can save a life.
Yeah.
So you just need to use it. You just need to give it.
But
so
why?
This is serious.
Yeah. I mean, naloxone is not free. But as you said, people who use drugs typically get it at no cost from these harm reduction programs. But why is Narcan so expensive?
Well, the generic goes in between $20 and $40.
Uh-huh.
Then there, and naloxone can be sold, for example, you can sell it for injection, or you can sell it in order to be able to administer it intranasally. And these different formulations can cost different amounts of money. So if you want to administer it intranasally, it costs approximately $130 to $140 for two doses. And then there's an auto injector that's more expensive, that is $3,000-$4,000. So there is a variability, and I think that this is the way that the producers of these products are actually trying to recover their investments, like any other drug. And so we've been trying to work because we have helped develop these formulations as an organization at the NIH. We have been trying to work with the companies to get them to provide the products at prices that are accessible, and to ensure that the insurances are actually helping to pay for this, so that the cost to the person is minimal. We want naloxone widely distributed.
Yeah, I want to pause right here with Dr. Nora Volkoff, directs the National Institute on Drug Abuse at NIH. Before COVID, addiction to opioids was largely considered the biggest public health crisis in our country. Have you or a loved one struggled with addiction? What can you say about it? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Opioid-related deaths in the U.S. surged last year in the pandemic. We're discussing next steps here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC report found that opioids and illegally manufactured fentanyl, in particular, were the biggest culprits in the rise of overdose deaths last year. The National Institute on Drug Abuse says fentanyl is up to 100 times more potent than morphine. Are you or a loved one having struggles with addiction? Where have you sought treatment? Did you relapse? What has helped along your journey to sobriety? 800-642-1234. Dr. Nora Volkoff leads the National Institute on Drug Abuse, stays with us here. Dr. Volkoff, I want to ask you about syringe service programs, or these, you know, needle exchange programs providing sterile syringes to injection drug users and the ability to dispose of dirty needles. We saw West Virginia putting stricter regulation around these programs that could cause harm reduction programs to shut down. Are these syringe service programs effective?
They have been shown by multiple independent studies that they are actually quite effective in preventing infections from HIV, in preventing infections for hepatitis C, in helping linking individuals to treatment when they are ready to receive it for their substance use disorder, in helping them provide support from the community and the interactions that they have. So no one is questioning that these the syringe exchange programs are actually an effective help harm reduction intervention. There's no more need to do more work. We know they are effective.
But critics would argue that they enable dangerous behavior. Is there any evidence of this?
Well, I there is no evidence that they facilitate the harmful behavior. In fact, I mean, people that are addicted really don't choose to take these drugs. It's almost like a hunger or a thirst that the person has. And so you cannot choose not to eat if you're very, very hungry. So if you do not get safe syringes and you have this intense craving and distress because you cannot alleviate it, you're going to go and inject using whatever you find. And this, we know, this is one of the big challenges about addiction, that it actually overtakes your decision making and your ability to control the urges. So there's no evidence that it promotes any dangerous behavior on people that are already taking drugs. It actually, as I mentioned before, it mitigates some of the harmful effects. And if we don't provide this, the individuals will use very risky behaviors, and their outcomes actually can be quite tragic. So that's not a justification to curtail access to syringe exchange programs. There's no evidence.
Do you see that these syringe services are a gateway to treatment for opioids?
There has been several reports of researchers that look into how syringe exchange programs actually affect the lives of people with substance use disorders, and when an individual is ready to access care, they have helped them achieve the connection. And in some instances, the syringe exchange programs are directly linked with treatments in the community. So they serve that purpose too.
We're talking with Dr. Nora Volkoff, who is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the NIH, and we're discussing the surge in overdose deaths in the first year of the pandemic with the new CDC data out, and taking your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. Dwayne is joining us from Weston this morning. Hi, Dwayne. What can you tell us about your story?
So about a year ago, I just got a call from my son and said, it was this girl down south. She passed from an overdose, fentanyl, I imagine. And she just got out of the Air National Guard training to be a flight medic, turning her life around, had a daughter. Mm-hmm. Just one night out with an old boyfriend and overdosed and left behind a little girl and crushed her family. And and she knew people too down, Louisiana, that she knew several people I talked to that have passed from overdoses. And then another story, this was just a week ago, my friend's a fireman. We're coming back fishing. He said, "You never gonna guess what happened." Took my daughter down to the park by their house. There's a bridge right there by the river. And he found five little clear plastic packets. Hmm. 1-inch square, and there was like brown sugar in them, all sealed up, and just like not trying to be hit or anything for like a pickup later. Probably fell out of a backpack. So they called, sprang the police. They came. It was fentanyl, $2,800 worth, I think they said it ended up being a value. But so parents should be really, talking to their kids if they find anything wrapped like that, So those are two things that.
Two stories. Yeah, Dwayne, thank you for sharing those stories. One about accidental overdoses and the other about child accidentally seeing it. Dr. Volkoff, what would you say?
Well, that it is these very tragic stories are stories that we're hearing all over America. It's not one region or the other, it's one group or the other, it's one age or the other. We're seeing everyone affected, and the issue now with the type of drugs that are accessible and available and being sold is that they're extraordinarily dangerous. And so when one says fentanyl is, say, 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin, that really, sometimes people don't realize what that means in terms of the risk that they're posing to their lives when you take a drug, because most drugs now are contaminated with fentanyl. Is a way that the dealers can increase their profits. And when you have a situation like that in a park where a child can actually come across drug paraphernalia, I mean, that they by their curiosity, they are going to go touch. If you touch fentanyl, you get exposed with fentanyl in your hands. That can actually be dangerous. And sometimes the drugs are even more potent than fentanyl. So this is a very dangerous market for drugs, and the risks are much higher than what we had, even with pure heroin. So it's a different world.
I want to ask you about the country's three major drug companies reaching that $26 billion settlement with states over the opioid crisis. What do you think is the best way to use this money?
Well, this is money that should be used to actually alleviate the suffering caused by these industries. Selling of huge amounts of opioid medications that trigger the opioid crisis that we currently have. So it should go for treatment and prevention and education in order to be able to help curtail what has been triggered by those practices.
Treatment, education, medicine, how do you educate? How do you reduce the stigma?
Yeah, no, and certainly, and prevention, I want to say. How do we educate? I think that there are many ways that we can educate, but we have to start to educate. One of the things that has surprised me when I go to places where there's a serious problem with fentanyl overdoses is that sometimes people don't really even know how dangerous it is.
Mm.
So we need to educate people that what drugs are and why they are dangerous and what are the consequences. We need to educate them about what is addiction and that it is actually a disease that happens to some and not others, and that it can be treated and that people recover.
Dr. Volkoff, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nora Volkoff, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. Ahead this hour, we look at how the pandemic has led to a major shift in school enrollment. Have you signed your children up at a different school or started homeschooling? How did you arrive at the decision? We'll talk about it. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
For many of us, pets are part of our families. And what we keep to remember our pets who have passed away can take many forms. It can be a dog's old collar, or maybe a cat's favorite toy. Or in some cases, it may be a part of the pet itself. A one-of-a-kind piece of art or jewelry created by a very specialized blacksmith and artist named Lisa Lauren. WPR's Stephen Potter introduces us to this artist's work. A note of warning, the following story discusses animal processing.
Hi!
Hi. On the east side of Madison, Lisa Lauren shows me around her home and workshop.
Welcome to my house.
As she works, she explains what she does and why.
I have a business called Kettle Black Silver, and I process animals through that business in a variety of ways, as well as silversmith.
Aside from the occasional hunting trophy, most of the animal processing she does is of a pet that's passed away. In those cases, the owner wants to keep some part of their pet as a remembrance.
I think it's the same sort of emotion that someone would experience when they have an urn of a loved one given to them from a funeral home. You know, it's a very emotional, happy but grieving, bittersweet kind of reaction that most people have. I've done bone altars before. I've done wind chimes made out of bones. I've done sort of just like wall hangings with bones.
To clean up and carve some of the bones she processes, Lauren uses a blowtorch, a jewelry saw, and a rotary tool.
And it sounds like this. Usually when someone pays for me to do this, they have an idea of what they want done. So sometimes they just want all of the bones and they want them cleaned and they just want me to give them the bones cleaned. Sometimes they only want the skull. Sometimes people do want like a foot. I've made like feet keychains I've done a few times, like a rabbit foot keychain, but like a cat foot keychain.
As with all custom made art, the pieces she makes are similar, yet unique.
So I'm a silversmith by trade. Under the business Kettle Black Silver, I do a lot of other animal-related work with that. So most common thing that I get paid for is making a ring with someone's, or a necklace with someone's animal hair in it, or ashes. So I'll make, like, memorial jewelry like that. I really like the art of it, and I really do like being able to have an alternative way for people to commemorate their animals.
Lauren also makes art and jewelry from wild animals that have died outdoors. In doing that, she makes an important distinction.
So I find things myself. Everything that I sell has been things that I have found personally out hiking. I'm outside a lot, like I said, and I've collected things throughout my whole life. It's extremely important for me to be telling my customers that everything I find has not been killed for the purpose of its art.
Lauren says people like animal bone art for a number of reasons. One of her most popular pieces is a ring with a coyote tooth in the place where a gemstone would be.
I think it's just part of a certain style that people really like. I think people like the way it looks, and I think it's something that's kind of unique and different. You really can't mass produce it.
Lauren understands that the act of animal processing, which involves removing meat and skin from bone, isn't for everyone.
And I get how it's taboo, and I still even see it as taboo in a little bit of a way, but I try to remember that we do this as a process to feed our bodies, and this is really the same process. If you kind of try to think about it in that way, it becomes a little bit less taboo.
Stephen Potter is a producer for the Ideas Network. He talked with Lisa Laurent of Kettle Black Silver. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And now to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that shows a big shift in where kids attended school last year. Homeschooling and virtual charter schools made big gains in the first year of the pandemic, a historic drop in public school enrollment, but there are nuances there. Did you enroll your child in a virtual charter school last year, or did you take on teaching and homeschooling? Did you hold your five-year-old back from starting school? What is the plan for this year? 800-642-1234 to join in. Mark Sommerhauser is Communications Director and Policy Researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's the author of the report. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Absolutely. It's great to be with you.
Well, give us a sense of your numbers, the number of children who shifted to a different virtual option, like an online charter school or homeschool.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we don't actually have data on which kids shifted. We do have a lot of data that we collected for this report that just looks at the enrollment of each sort of school sector. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of what was the basis for our report. So homeschool enrollment, probably the most eye-popping numbers here. We saw an increase of 47% in a single school year last school year in homeschool enrollment. That went up from a little less than 22,000 students to a little less than 32,000. This enrollment increase, of course, was massive. It was the largest in a single year since at least 1984, which is the earliest year we have data for, and we think it's pretty likely it was the largest, you know, single year increase ever. The other piece that was an important part of our report was charter school enrollment. Charter schools saw enrollment up about 14% last year, mm-hmm. and the vast majority of that increase was driven by virtual charter schools. They saw their enrollment up about 84%. From a little less than 9,000 students to about 16,000 students. So, of course, you know, there are more than 800,000 students in Wisconsin public schools. These numbers remain obviously quite small in comparison to that. But still, we thought it was really striking and frankly, just unprecedented, at least any time in modern times, to see a year-to-year increases
jumps
of that,
like that.
That magnitude. Yeah.
Yeah. Mark, a little reporter's notebook here for us, if you will. Where did your data come from and how did you work with it, manipulate it?
Yeah, so all of our data came from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, the statewide K-12 agency. And it is based on the counts that are taken on the third Friday in September. Those are enrollment counts that all public school districts are required to take each year for purposes of calculating their revenue limits and other things. So that was the basis for what we worked with.
Moving to the public school enrollment, you found a historic drop. What happened there in public schools?
Yeah, so public school enrollment was down about 2.9%. And that was, you know, to put a little context around that, school enrollment, public school enrollment in Wisconsin has been declining. This last school year was the seventh consecutive year that it declined. But that said, you know, the decline of about 3%, almost 3%, was definitely by far the largest decline, both within the last 7 years. But we have data for on public school enrollment for about the last 25 years, and it was the largest one-year decline within that period of time. It also with last year's decline reached its lowest, you know, total amount that it had been at in the last 25 years. So pretty notable there as well.
But you had some nuances there. You found that, you know, pre-K and kindergarten had much greater drops than what you saw at the high school level.
That's correct. Yeah. So, you know, when we first saw this enrollment decline, we thought, okay, is this uniform? Are there differences by grade levels? And what we found when we broke it down by the grade levels was the differences were huge. The pre-K enrollment was down about 16%. Kindergarten enrollment down about 5%. Then we get up to grades 1 through 8, lumping all of those grades together. And that's a more modest decline, about 2.8%. At the high school level, enrollment actually ticked up. It increased very slightly, about 0.2%. And looking at the private school enrollment data as well, we see a largely similar pattern there. So, you know, we think this suggests that the enrollment decline might have been driven, at least in part, by families who, you know, sort of opted to delay starting their youngest learners, especially their pre-K students, in, you know, like a public school setting during the pandemic. So obviously we're going to find out this year, you know, kind of what happens, but.
Yeah. And I know you say to exercise really extreme caution in drawing conclusions or interpretations of what's going on. I'm going to reintroduce you here. Mark Sommerhauser is policy researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's author of a new report. It found large increases in virtual charter and homeschool enrollment last year. We saw public school enrollment declines. So, Mark, looking more closely at the private school enrollments, that they have essentially fluctuated basically from year to year. What happened last year?
Yeah, so private school enrollment declined about 1.5% last year. So, you know, not as big of a decline as the public schools, but it was, you know, in terms of comparing to recent years, as you said, the private school enrollment has kind of bounced around a bit. This was the largest one-year decline since 2013. Also, again, for context, private school enrollment in Wisconsin did hit its lowest point, at least in a decade, with the last year's decline. So, you know, a notable trend there as well. And one of the reasons we found that interesting is there was, you know, a little bit of reporting and a little bit of suggestion early in the pandemic that we might see, you know, kind of this trend or this shift of a lot of students leaving public schools, going to the private school setting. You know, obviously, we don't really think that's supported very strongly by what we see in these data, given the decline in private school enrollment as well. It does appear that obviously the increases were what we discussed previously among homeschool and virtual charters.
My guess, it's kind of complex and there's a lot of push-pull here because, you know, last year we had huge job losses and furloughs, family budgets getting really strained. I would have guessed that private school enrollment would have dropped even more. And yet, you know, I listened to our neighbors putting their kids in private school because it offered daily classroom instruction and something they needed in order to keep going to work each day. So, you know, my question is whether that might also have been a trend and whether these students will one day return to public school.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. I mean, obviously, every family, you know, had different circumstances, but the issue you present is definitely an issue that, whether it's because of work or other reasons, that, you know, some parents might have been seeking, you know, an in-person instruction setting. Other parents, perhaps concerned about the virus, wanting to minimize any exposure to the virus, might have made the opposite decision and made a shift to avoid having their children be in that in-person setting so their children could be learning remotely. So it really just kind of depended on the circumstances, family to family. In terms of what's going to happen, you know, in this school year, that's kind of what every school district is on pins and needles right now wondering. You know, I think obviously most districts right now are still enrolling students, and it'll be a little bit of time till we know for sure. Probably sometime in October is when we'll have at least some statewide data from the public school enrollment.
Well, Mark, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be with you.
Mark Sommerhauser, Communications Director and Policy Researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We have a link to the report at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we talk with the administrator of the online charter, the Rural Virtual Academy, made up of a consortium of dozens of public school districts. Have you switched schools? What do you want to know about the online charter system? It's 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the enrollment growth of online charter schools amid the pandemic on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Medford Area Public School District back in 2005 authorized the opening of the Rural Virtual Academy Charter School, or RVA. And over the years, dozens of public school districts are now affiliated with the RVA. According to the Department of Public Instruction, there are more than 50 charter schools operating in our state, four new ones that opened last year. What do you think schools could do to improve remote or virtual learning? Have you looked at an online charter? 800-642-1234. Charlie Heckel, he is administrator of the RVA, serving 1,800 students across Wisconsin this year. Charlie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Good morning. How has last year been for your virtual charter school? What has it been like?
Good morning, Kate. Well, thank you. Yeah, last year, throughout the pandemic, it was relatively normal for us, albeit virtual charter schools weren't primarily built in the early 2000s for pandemic reasons. We certainly were able to serve children adequately, though, through all the closures and in disarray that was taking place in traditional public schools last year.
Did you see the surge in applications or, parents wanting to get their children enrolled?
We did, Kate. We saw thousands of applications and families calling us seeking to potentially have their children enroll within our school. We were unfortunately unable to meet the demand there. Our board helps us set size and capacities each year to be able to maintain, sustainable fiscal growth of our school. But yes, we literally saw thousands of families and children seeking different options last year.
What is your capacity limited by? Is it a lack of teachers or just how you administrate the program? What has to contain you?
Yes, it is really a matter of ensuring that we are growing with quality and not growing too fast. And we measure what the our partner school districts that we now work with over 50 Wisconsin school districts, and we look at what the needs are within their local communities as well as across the state, and we do our best to try to predict how big our school needs to be on an annual basis. But at the same time, we do not want to grow so fast that it diminishes any of the quality of educational opportunities that we provide to our families.
You know, for so many students, it was their first time in a virtual classroom last year, certainly for my kids. And it was such a wake-up call to parents and to kids and to teachers who had never really maneuvered through this environment for elementary and middle school in particular, in my case. What is that like for families that you have to help navigate them through this new type of classroom? Do you have any tips for how you do that?
Absolutely. And again, here at Rural Virtual Academy, we had a 16-year head start in compared to traditional school districts in Wisconsin who really were asked and required to do nearly the impossible, which was to try to conduct remote learning opportunities built in the matter of months as opposed to years. And here at RVA, we have systems and protocols in place that help onboard families through multiple orientation sessions and personalized learning opportunities to ensure that families and children understand the technologies and their pacing and their curriculum as we go.
Yeah, what does classroom size look like compared to maybe a typical classroom of 20, 25, 30 kids?
That's a great question. Here at Rural Virtual Academy in our live synchronous instructional classes from K-12, we hold our class sizes at about the same 25 to 30 students per class.
We have had so many issues with broadband and internet connection problems in Wisconsin, especially in rural areas. What have you seen for the lack of broadband, and what have your families experienced?
That's a great question, Kate. We do serve families all throughout the state of Wisconsin, and I would tell you from my perspective, it's not so much that a family cannot get connected to the internet. I see it as more about equitable accessibility for all families across Wisconsin. You know, as we look across the landscape, rural Wisconsinites, they do have options to connect to the internet, albeit though maybe through satellite or data plans through cell phones. But in these cases, those plans oftentimes don't provide high speed access. They're not stable, and they're cost prohibitive. So what I see on the landscape is that rural Wisconsinites often have to live with less than satisfactory connections, unreliable connection speeds, and they're paying a lot of money for that.
Have you given families any workarounds or tips if they are having these types of barriers?
Well, we as a school help reimburse families for their internet connections during the time that their children are in school, which helps does subsidize and helps cover partial of the cost for their connections to the internet for their kids to be able to attend school on a high-speed internet connection. And then we will also provide families connected devices to their homes and assist them with networking through our own systems if they are unable to find a satisfactory connection from where they live.
We're talking with Charlie Heckel, administrator of the Rural Virtual Academy. It's an online charter school system serving 1,800 students across Wisconsin this year. And taking your questions, do you think your child excels or is set back in a remote learning format? What have you seen? What have you experienced in the pandemic year? 800-642-1234. Charlie, how do you respond to critics who say that students miss out on really important social emotional socialization in virtual classrooms?
It's a legitimate concern for everybody to ask, but I say here at Rural Virtual Academy, we put the socialization of our children at the forefront. We have an activities director. We have 15 people whom we call are titled regional event coordinators, whose sole purposes are to plan events all throughout the state of Wisconsin, both in person and online. Last year, even during the pandemic, where we were forced to do all of our activities online, we had over nearly 8,000 participants take place in over 120 different online events. This year, our goal is to have closer to 150 events serving about 10,000 participants through across those events. So we make it a priority, and I encourage families to take a look at our ruralvirtual.org website and click on activities. You'll see a calendar of events where there are in-person activities going on nearly every day of the school year.
Very quickly, as we have to wrap up here, what do you think of retention? Do you think you will hold these numbers after the pandemic ends?
Great question, Kate. We are actually, we had projected a 20% increase in our enrollment, and it appears that we'll be meeting that mark by our mid-September state-mandated pupil membership count.
Charlie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kate. I appreciate talking to you this morning.
Charlie Heckel, administrator of the Rural Virtual Academy. And for disclosure, RVA is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. We discuss how climate change is affecting dairy farmers in ways that science and technology can make the dairy industry more sustainable. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.